Oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt, thaw and resolve itself into an audio interview at the Edinburgh Fringe. And I'm delighted to be joined by...
Tony Cronin.
And...
Julia McIlvaine.
Yeah, and this is the world premiere of a new comedy called Spirit of the Dane. The subtitle is He's Back, Hamlet that is, and he's not happy about it. Tell us a bit more about that.
The basic concept is the character of Hamlet as written is, I think, misrepresented by stage productions more often than not. So having done a lot of Hamlets, I thought, what would Hamlet think if he could talk to the audience, to the modern people, the modern mind? You know, Alan Bloom has got the great book about, you know, the making of the human, and Hamlet is a key character. And I'm like, Alan, you know, get a grip. They wrote this 400 years ago. The point of view is different. So that's sort of the beginning of the thought.
So how are we misrepresenting him in most productions now?
Well, I think people put stuff onto him instead of mining the script deeply enough. For example, a thing I've been saying to people is in Act 4, when he's talking to his mother, they get through the fight, he tells her he's going to England. And I say, well, how does he know this? And there's only one scene in the play where he would know that. It was after the nunnery scene. Claudius first mentions, I'm going to send him to England, and the only two people on stage are Polonius and Ophelia, which tells us that Ophelia and Hamlet are colluding, to use a current term, the entire play, which changes a lot of the shape of the scenes. And if you sort of ignore that clue in the script, you don't really get the story as was written. And so I think that happens a lot. People are doing the Olivier Hamlet, or they're doing the Branagh Hamlet, or they're doing the Cumberbatch Hamlet because they saw it instead of mining the script.
And is that also the fact that, you know, if you take a word like anthropomorphizing, which is, and it's terrible when your cat or your dog dies because you've turned them into a human being. You've imposed something of you onto them. You know, I guess we're imposing a lot of years and different developments in media and culture onto a play that was written quite a long time ago and was in a very different milieu.
Exactly.
This is actually a line that he has in the script about wanting to make Hamlet into something that is more appropriate for a modern audience, something that we can more easily relate to. That's actually a line that you have in your prologue, in your opening monologue. But more often than not, we've been finding through even rehearsing this that it's not crimes of, well, I don't want it to be the way it is, I want it to be different. It's crimes of omission. It's crimes of not having looked at it in a non-intimidated way and going, okay, well, what does this actually mean? If this word in this context, what is this person actually saying? And seeing it honestly, so often we go to, well, I don't really know what that means, so I saw it this way on stage once, and I'm going to do it like that because I thought it looked cool. So it's crimes of youthful brain, sort of.
So if we're mad, but north-northwest, but, you know, when the wind is southerly, you know, we see the real Hamlet, how do you make sure that your wish to correct, wish to interpret, isn't just another interpretation?
By going back to the script. Lady Macbeth comes into the play because in my Hamlet, he's an actor and he sort of craves all the other great lines from Shakespeare because he's in the world of fiction. If you read Lady Macbeth and you look at the Lady Macbeth, she has that one line about plucking her breast from the boneless gums. That, if you don't really find a backstory that explains that line, Lady Macbeth is not full. So you have to figure out if she was a mother, she had to, at one point, what happened to the kid, who was a father. There's a whole story, which Julia and I happen to feel the same way, about what made her into this thing. So it's a matter of mining. I don't think we'll ever be right, because we can't go back to the Elizabethan or the Jacobean era, but, you know, they were serious about their religion. I mean, the guy who wrote the Geneva Bible, Tinsdale, they killed him. I mean, they killed him by screwing a thing around his neck. So his era, the religious conversation was deadly serious. And Hamlet, it's just rife with religious illusion. He's talking about the undiscovered country.
I think another way that we deal with that question in this production in particular is by not over-costuming, not oversetting anything, is that we are very clearly actors who happen to have been chosen by these characters at this moment for this purpose, for this message. This is not the definitive Hamlet, the definitive truth about any of these people, because you're never in a position to do that. It's always going to be an interpretation, because he's not Hamlet. Like, we can all agree on that.
He looks like Hamlet to me. but that's my American Hollywood Hamlet.
Yeah, we talk about that in his monologue also. But it's admitting that it will always be an interpretation, and as such, it's your duty to interpret it as faithfully as possible, while recognizing that the marriage between actor and character is what's going to make it unique to you.
So,
and that's
just checking. So you guys have at least gone back beyond the sort of Baudelaireized Victorian one that took all the naughty bits out.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yes, and I think the trick is anyone who you obviously know the play, and people who know the play, it's a sacred text. We know there's something there that is unspeakable, right? It goes beyond whatever it is. And then there's just the great play. There's the adventure story. There's the revenge story. There's the love story. So whatever level you want to go down to is the trick. And I think the power of the play is in the deeper levels. And I think Shakespeare knew what he was writing. And I think he's a lot smarter than I will ever be. And so I want to try to trust what he wrote and what I can find out of that. Peter Brook, when he did the Hamlet in Paris with, I forget who did it, Adrian Lester did Hamlet. He says, the most interesting line in the play to me is when the father's ghost says, "Taint not thy own mind." And it's a brilliant moment because you think, yes, what is he talking about? It's like how murder, how revenge, how killing anyone else affects a human being. And once you carry that into the play, it changes just the complexion of so much of the play. I use that in our play. And I think with Macbeth, which is the other great tragedy, I mean, Lear's tremendous, but you have the same question. I always feel that the sergeant's speech in Act 1, Scene 2, is the key to that play. When he describes him going across the battlefield and then gutting McDonwell from the nave to the chops, he's describing a scene of bloodlust, of madness, of blood madness. And then Macbeth shows up. So I think we don't know the history, but if he went to the wars, he certainly knew guys coming back from the French wars who were a little twisted by that.
Now, you're being interviewed by a man who's been to Elsinore in Denmark, and I had a hamburger there. I want some answers here. Okay, yeah. So does he at any point go mad, or is it all pretense?
It's all pretend. He says it specifically in Act 1, Scene 4, to Horatio and Marcellus on the scene. He says, if I act mad, it's because I'm not. Okay? So, strategically, my feeling is, Hamlet is a great soldier as taught by his father.
Yeah.
He knows immediately that if what his father said is true, his father's ghost said is true, then he is a target for Claudius. So it becomes sort of a born identity of hide and seek. And the only way he can keep himself and keep Claudius off balance is by playing madness and making believe he breaks up with Ophelia. Because like the Godfather, it's like they go after your family, right?
Yeah. And let's be clear also, there's no evidence that he's a great sword fighter.
No. No, there's none at all. But we do know that he has practiced a lot.
Yeah.
And he's prepared. And when we did my last show, I kept telling them during the fight choreography, point beats blade. As in the evolution of sword fighting, is, you know, the big slashing became defeated by the foil and the rapier. As a blade, as you go in, it's a shorter distance, it's quicker.
Yeah.
And it's a more intellectual way of fighting. So I tried to stage a sword fight with that, because it's an interesting point you bring up, how he defeats Laertes and why. But if your father was a great general, he would say, never show your cards, right?
So let's be clear here, too. You're going to get your Shakespeare audience coming to this. But let's say I'm one of, and I'd say a lot of typical people here in the UK, up at the fringe, looking for shows to see. And you two look smart, you know, savvy in the world. You know, and I kind of left Shakespeare behind when I was traumatized by the way it was taught at school. But can I come to see this show as a thing in its own right?
Absolutely, and I think the inclusion of Lady Macbeth is a huge reason why that's true. Because
let's just do a double take. The inclusion of Lady Macbeth. Let's go with that.
Oh gosh, I'm sorry. Have we not gone there yet?
This is like a free gift. Come on.
Well, because Hamlet is our way in, but Hamlet needs a foil because Hamlet likes to talk and he likes to think and he likes to weigh things. He's highly intellectual and he's dissatisfied with some elements of his story, namely the stuff that you guys have talked about already. Lady Macbeth and the ethos of Macbeth and how those two think is probably the perfect opposite to Hamlet. Hamlet's very deliberative. He has to weigh everything. He has to know what he's going to do miles before he does it. Whereas Lady M is the opposite. She goes, this is logic. This is what needs to happen. This is the important thing. So therefore, it is already done. And watching the two of them kind of square off with each other, in addition to being instructive, is just funny as hell.
Just checking, so this, just so everyone knows, this is a kind of buy one, get one free Shakespeare here.
The central conceit to the play is all fictional characters only exist in our minds, okay? And that when a human thinks about a fictional character, that's when he comes into being. And so, since Hamlet is a great actor, I mean, he gives Charlton Heston acting lessons, right? I have him craving all the other great lines in Shakespeare. One of the lines he's particularly craving is Macbeth's Tomorrow and Tomorrow speech. So when he does that, it triggers Lady Macbeth in this fictional world where fictional, and she comes down to see what's going on.
So 'tis now the very witching time of the interview, that if we now take off this distorted skin that's been laid over it for so many years, based on your research and your experience of it, what have you discovered?
I think I have discovered that the heart of these plays is very precise and it's very powerful, and in the Western modern mind, we want to think we know the answers. And I think he's writing on a very deep psychological and mythological level. And the power of Hamlet comes from that mystery and the association with it.
Let be.
She brings up one of the key phrases I think is important is the readiness is all. And the question one wants to ask is, ready for what? And I think it's very clear to me that Hamlet's talking, I'm ready to die. What he's not ready to do before then is ready to die. So if the readiness is all speech is specifically to death, the complexion of the end of the play, because Horatio's, don't fight him, you might die. He goes, I'm ready to die. He wasn't ready in The Rogue and Peasant Slave. He wasn't ready in To Be or Not to Be. The whole thing is, what is it? Now I'm ready. He's dealt with the pirates. He's dealt with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. He's become the warrior king. And the one thing you must do is be ready to die. And I think that is a Christian, very Christian idea on the true level of Christianity, where it's like, no, every day you have to, you know, find yourself in the grace of God so that if you die today, you'll go to the undiscovered country.
But also, you know, having played Hamlet in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern myself when I was a lot younger, you know, all I really got to do, and I enjoyed it, was to spit into the wind. You know, I was painted as a quite comic, self-obsessed dumbass, really.
Yeah. But I think that's
all there. That's part of the other beauty that we've been discovering even through rehearsing this and developing this script, this story, is that none of these characters are one-sided. So often they're played that way because it's easier or it's cleaner somehow, but all of them have all of these different motivations. I mean, they're all multidimensional, and that's what's been so much fun to play, is that Hamlet is a little bit self-obsessed, but he's also generous and beautiful.
But also, now, just coming to the kind of almost the rehearsal room, but then playing Hamlet, with all of that that's been overlaid, how did you find the Hamlet that you wanted to play?
I just, by basically, the writing is a backstory. So he's like complaining about how one of the reasons he's a college kid who hasn't graduated at 28 or 29 is because Shakespeare was holding a grudge against college boys. So he's the ultimate clueless college kid, and he makes mistakes. So by going back through this sort of, you know, you opened the interview with the sullied flesh speech. It's such an interesting speech because he's whining about almost all the wrong things.
Fie.
Yeah. But it's like, I just want to die. Mommy married my uncle. And it's like, dimwit, you just lost the crown. You were supposed to be king. It never enters his mind. He's a little obsessed with his mother and the emotional feeling, doesn't really care about the fact that he's supposed to be king. He's not ready to be the king. So I found this sort of child in me, I think.
I think you did well.
So just a final couple of questions. So I just want a flavor of the rehearsal room.
Well, interestingly, we rehearsed this in Los Angeles, where we both work in the entertainment industry. A lot of it was in Santa Monica, where we have our theater. We have a little Shakespeare company in Santa Monica. So we work around the table a lot. We spend as much time as we can at the library, where we just sort of play with the script and talk about it and sort of discover it. Julia brings a great both insight and skill to the play. She's been a huge help. And we just allowed it to become what it was. And
what's the inside skill?
We come at it from slightly different perspectives. Tony being not only the actor but also the playwright, his perspective is a little more story-driven, a little more intellectual, academic, as obviously based on his really incredible experience with this subject matter. Mine is very much more about playability and character development. So he comes at it well with, this is the story, and this is the kind of, these are the jokes and the moments that I want to get in. I'm like, okay, but how do you play that? How are we going to string that together into something that an audience can relate to on a visceral or a narrative level? So it was a lot of co-development like that. It's been really fun. It's been great.
And Julia has this great ability to take an intellectual thought, and she then finds a way to translate it into an emotional acting moment, which is really beautiful to watch. In fact, the reviewer from the other
baby?
Yeah, called her hauntingly beautiful, which is an interesting. But it really, she is, because she's able to emotionally sort of fulfill these ideas. So it's fun, and it's fun, and we trust each other, I think, which is really helpful.
Final question, probably to the writer, actually, which is, and we don't even know who Shakespeare was. There's been several shows up here recently that have suggested he's, was it Edward,
Edward De Vere,
mm-hmm. and, you know, various people. But so whatever Shakespeare you've decided wrote this, yeah. if he came to watch Spirit of the Dane and came up to you afterwards, you know, would you get smashed in the teeth, or do you think you'd go and have an ancient middle-aged beer together?
I think he would have a beer together. He'd be happy. People have been responding. We've had rolling laughter the whole show, so people are getting the jokes, and I think he would understand. And I think while he may not agree with as we recreate the backstories, he would know that we've thought about it as opposed to made gross assumptions of what it is. So I think he would enjoy what we've done with the show.
And you could, of course, dine on this for the rest of your lives with all the plays that have been written coming back year after year. But it's Hamlet this year with a touch of Lady Macbeth. So thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.